the November edition of the podcast. Our theme this month is Pass the Wishbone, a subtle allusion to the Thanksgiving holiday, the start of the annual holiday season, and the one day a year that Americans are expected, encouraged even, to consider what they have to be thankful for. Usually, for me, that means being thankful that we have only one holiday season a year. But this year is different. This year I am also thankful that I was not trapped in the car with the characters in our featured story this month, which is called The Driving Hour, and it's by Darcy Schumer.
In the fervor of his courtship, Tom promised to take Meg to Cambria, California, the small central coast town where he lived until he was 20 years old. He promised it in his usual way, grandiose, believing each syllable as it spilled from his mouth, though he had no idea of how he would enact his plan. Now it is 2 years later, and with Meg's prodding and pressure from their friends Billy and June, Tom has finally pieced together a trip for the four of them. They're planning to leave within the hour, and Tom and Billy are waiting for the girls to finish readying themselves. "Tom, we have everything, right?" Billy asks. "And plenty of..." He puts his index finger on his right nostril and inhales. "Who do you think you're traveling with, my friend? Of course I have blow. Other than that, we'll only be gone a couple days, and we can always buy what we don't have," Tom says. "I'm just wondering what the fuck is taking those two girls so long." "They are the fairer sex." "Right, fairer, as in more fair." "So I take it that you and Meg really haven't straightened out whatever happened at the CC Club the other night." "You know how the more fair are. They never get over anything. Meg's no different." "What exactly happened anyway? June said you were talking to some other girl." "I'm sure she said it with an eyebrow raised." Billy sighs. "Well?" "I have to answer to you too?" Tom shakes his head. "It was nothing. I was outside talking to this girl, Karen, and Meg flipped out." "How do you know her?" "She was in a couple of my philosophy classes at school." "So why did Meg get so pissed about it?" "Karen is truly a member of the fairer sex." He turns toward Billy, leaving a dramatic pause. "Do the math." "Yeah, but nothing was going on, right?" Tom turns from Billy toward the TV. A woman whirls across the screen, holding a bottle of shampoo, her blonde hair spinning out behind her. "We were just reminiscing," he says, keeping his eyes on the television. Well, at one time he had been. Billy is no longer Tom's confessor, not since Tom started dating Billy's girlfriend's best friend, Meg. Something changed between them then, something like Liberty Lost. Tom censors himself when he talks to Billy now, knowing that anything he says could get back to Meg. "Meg doesn't really let me out of her sight too often. So what do you think I'd really be able to do?" he mutters. "So something happened before?" "You automatically assume that?" "That's usually why a girlfriend wouldn't let someone out of her sight." "Et tu, Billy?" Tom says, just as thankfully the girls come out of the bedroom. "Ladies, you look stunning. Shall we?" he says. "We have an epic journey before us." "Let's have a bump before we go," Meg says. "Anything for you, Nutmeg," Tom says. Meg rolls her eyes. "What?" Tom says, cutting the lines of coke on Meg's glass coffee table. They all gather around the table, kneeling down over the glass. "Onward," Tom says, inhaling the sting and wake of the drug, while he looks at the National Geographic magazine beneath, a jungle on the cover with a kid soldier in the corner, his gun alert at his side. The others follow suit, and soon all their hearts are fluttering. "We're taking my car, aren't we?" Meg asks. "Tom? Would you like for us to take your car, Nutmeg?" "I already have a lot of music in there that everyone will like. My camera and everything is in there, too." "Then your car it is," Tom says, feeling his jaw tighten. He knows there is a reason behind her willingness, not just music and photography. Music had always lived in her periphery, and photography, the reason Tom had initially been attracted to her, had become her dying art. Recently, she had settled for a job taking photographs at Sears. So it is not what is already in her car that is behind her willingness, but that they would be in her car. It is the power using her car affords her over the trip that she wants. The same reason she insists night after night that Tom stay at her apartment, even when they have separate plans. As they walk to the car, wind swirls around them and Tom shivers. Even after 5 years in Minnesota, the winter still shocks his system. He pulls up the hood on his jacket. There's little snow on the ground, but Minneapolis, as often it is in February, has been bitterly cold for the past week. Sub-zero wind chills, dangerous temperatures. Colder than a witch's little titty out here, Tom says. I need to get closer to the homeland. Keys, Nutmeg? Meg throws the keys at him and he catches them hard in the stomach. Did you see that? He says to June. It's worse behind closed doors. Oh Christ, June says. Shut up and get in the car, California boy, before my little titties freeze off. Tom and Billy sit up front and the girls sit in the back. The car starts hard but warms up quickly. Tom plays Thin Lizzy's Jailbreak and turns up the volume. The whole car begins to sing. Tonight there's going to be a jailbreak somewhere in this town. The Honda races down 35W South. The car bar is now open, Tom says. He takes a pull from a bottle of Phillips gin and then passes it to the back seat. He moves in and out of lanes without using his blinker, as though the highway is his own little track and he must carry everyone through it safely. It is a performance, like his job waiting tables at Palomino. He's good at what he does. He often comes home with a couple $100 in tips after a busy evening. From spending a few years in the industry, he's learned how to play the customers. It isn't hard to sense what kind of person they want. Once he finds the personality they're looking for, silly, flirtatious, quiet, aloof, he adapts to it. It is a skill that can take him anywhere. Tom has just put in Loretta Lynn's Country Music Hall of Fame when June pokes her head between Tom and Billy's headrests. I have the perfect idea, June says. Why don't we stop in Vegas? Vegas? What would we do in Vegas, Tom says. You should know. It was your idea a long time ago. The double wedding, Tom? Meg says. Yeah, can't you imagine? It would be ridiculous. You and Meg and me and Billy in a little stupid chapel with rented clothes and lots of champagne. It's just like we talked about. Brilliant, June. I'm sure you and Meg have been planning that for a while. His tone slips a little, but he can't help it. They've all been trying to trap him for months, to pin him down to this plan or that plan. Billy slaps the side of Tom's head gently. June, you've always wanted a Vegas wedding, haven't you, baby? It's the only kind of wedding that I've wanted. Well, there's no time like the present. Let's do it. I want to get married by a fake Elvis wearing a white dress just like Marilyn Monroe wore when she stood on the vent. And I want pretty little panties with ruffles on the butt. Then that you shall have, ruffled panties and all. There is a gin slur in Billy's voice. Tom cringes at his triteness. Love you, baby, Billy says. I love you too, Billy. She leans into the front seat, a piece of her dyed blonde hair hitting Tom's neck. Then she and Billy kiss long, their mouths making light sounds, their heads blocking Tom's view of Meg. Tom says nothing, waiting tenuously for Meg to broach the subject, but she remains silent. He knows she's waiting for him to say something, anything that will bind them, but he's made up his mind not to give in to her. When Billy and June finish kissing, he finally speaks. Billy, let's have a little drink. Pass the bottle. He takes a swig of the gin. To June and Billy, he says. When the gin is passed around, everyone begins chattering lightly again, just as Tom had predicted. By the time they get to Vegas, he's sure that Meg will have forgotten all about June's wedding idea. For the next hour and a half, the car settles into a rhythm, alternating between narration and exclamation as Tom steals them farther and farther from home. They maintain this comfortable pace until they cross the Iowa border. Tom, I have to pee, Meg says. Yeah, I have to pee too, June adds. All right, keep your eyes open for rest stops. After driving a few more miles, Tom pulls off the interstate near Clear Lake, Iowa, and into the parking lot of a rest stop. The lights are on, but the parking lot is deserted except for one semi-truck at the opposite end. I'll go in and wait for you guys, Billy offers. You never know what kind of people could be hanging around here. You coming in, Tom? Nah, I'm just gonna stretch. Billy and the girls walk away, and Tom leans up against the car, listening to the interstate. There's so many cars, and he wonders where they are all going. He wishes he was in some other car, a car in which no one knew him quite so well, a car in which he had the freedom to be whomever he wanted. He unzips his coat and stretches, reaching his arms far above his head. Cold air rushes his damp armpits. He pulls the neck of his shirt away from his body. Then he stretches his fingertips towards his feet, and a stream of air trickles down his neck and back. Its light touch reminds him of Karen, how outside the CC Club the week before, she had hugged him, her cold little fingers running along the back of his neck, their bodies fully pressed together. Her breasts were soft against his chest, and her pelvis was flush against his. They were standing together the same way they had when they were lovers a few summers ago. He let his hand go so low as the start of her ass, and then his cock hardened, so he stayed close to her for another moment. Finally, Karen began to pull away, and it was then that Meg suddenly appeared, her mouth open slightly. He had done his best to play it off normal, but it was obvious Meg wasn't convinced the encounter had been purely friendly. In the bathroom later that night, Tom hid Karen's number between pictures in his wallet, where he was sure Meg wouldn't find it. He feels better now, knowing the number is safe, knowing he could call it and Karen would answer. He rests his thumb on the top of his wallet, the part that emerges from his denim pocket, thinking of the promise of Karen, thinking of all that possibility. Tom gets in the car just as Meg walks out of the rest stop. She is shadowed and slight against the building, small. For a moment, looking at her frame, he feels guilty. She climbs in the back seat, though there's no one in front. You weren't even going to say anything about it, were you? Tom exhales. He had expected this. What did you want me to say? I don't know, just something, anything to acknowledge the situation. You always make me feel ignored, just like a piece of crumpled up paper. Stop the theatrics. She lights a cigarette, a habit he hates despite his own affinity for speed and gin. It's embarrassing, she says. What's embarrassing? That I don't want to get married in Vegas? If anything, I think that's a credit to me as a person. I have standards that don't involve Elvis impersonators. But that's not... It's just... Her voice is becoming thinner. Tom rubs his face with his hands. Just what? Say it. Do you even want me? I mean, really. You didn't even acknowledge me in the car in front of our friends. We've been together longer than they have, and you don't even talk about marrying me. And then that shit outside of the CC Club, the way you were standing with that girl, something was going on. You looked goddamn guilty when I walked out there. So how do you think I feel right now? Can we just drop it, please? Can we just drop her? I dated her a couple years ago, and that was it. There was nothing going on. What was I supposed to do? Not even talk to that girl? He feels strange saying words that only have weight relative to his immediate position. When they are back in Minneapolis in her one-bedroom upper, he will no longer mean them in the same way. You both looked guilty. Meg, if you want to keep fucking talking about that, we can sit here all night. She's an old friend, and that's it. He pauses. Nothing happened, he says slowly, emphasizing each syllable. I'm not going to keep defending myself. The night is done, and it's over. And if you're that insecure, maybe it's your problem. He can hear her tears coming fast, her breathing is jagged. There are words he could string together to fix the situation, but he simply does not want to say them. He doesn't want to marry Meg, not in Vegas, and not ever. What do you even want from me? I want you to tell me you love me, Tom. Tell me right now. She touches his cheek. Look at me while you say it. Tell me right now. June and Billy are walking back toward the car. Tom sits quietly, watching them get closer. Tell me, she says, right now. Tom holds his ground, though he knows he's making things worse. Billy and June are steps away from the car when he swallows and turns around. I love you, Tom. Still, after all this, I love you, she says, tears running into her mouth. He can smell the remnants of cigarettes on her breath. He doesn't inhale for a second, refusing to take in the air she expels. In a moment, Billy and June will pull the car doors open. He doesn't want them to see him and Meg like this, not when he can't escape. I love you, Meg, he says, the words burning all the way up his throat. There, are you happy now? The dome light flashes on and Billy gets in the car. Meg immediately turns her face toward the window. Tom starts the ignition. How was the bathroom? He feigns happiness, hoping June won't notice Meg's red face. Just fine. What did we miss? June replies. Nothing, Meg says suddenly. You didn't miss anything. Tom pulls back on the highway, and soon the car settles into silence. The next couple hours prove melancholy. The further south and west they travel, the terrain flattens. Tom plays Towns Van Zandt and Leonard Cohen, Billy, June, and Meg mollified by the music and landscape. But Tom misses hills and valleys, the way they play hide and seek with trees and rocks and cattle. Flatlands are too obvious, too easy. Hey, Billy, he says, slapping Billy's knee with the back of his hand. I need a bump. I'm getting tired. Billy pulls out what looks like a bullet and puts a small mound of cocaine on the corner of a credit card. Tom takes it and inhales deeply. Better? Better, he says, putting on Iggy Pop and the Stooges. Slowly, the girls come alive again. They begin giggling, passing the bottle of gin, and Billy turns back and forth from the front seat to the back, laughing and joking with them. Tom grips the wheel, shifting around in his seat each time Meg's high-pitched laughter erupts. At the end of raw power, Meg leans into the front seat. Looks like the gas is low, she said. I think we should take this exit. She's smoking another cigarette. This exit looks like we might have to drive a long way to find a station. The low fuel light isn't on yet. It can wait. We aren't far from Des Moines. It's my car, Tom. I know my car. I think we can wait a few miles. The car isn't just going to die. The fucking expert, as always, she whispers in his ear. Tom grinds his teeth. She's snotty drunk now, and today, after everything, he cannot handle it. He lets his voice rise, no longer caring that he and Meg aren't alone. I'm gonna stop where and when I think the best fucking place is, since I'm driving and you're drunk. All hail the driving Nazi, says Meg, laughing. Don't be a bitch. Whatever, Tom, Billy says. It is her car. Don't say whatever. You sound like a fucking teenage girl. Do you trust my judgment or not, Billy? Tom, I trust you, but it's Meg's car. You're being an ass. June? Tom asks, ignoring Billy. It's Meg's car. She knows it best. The car goes silent as Tom steers them off the interstate and onto a dark two-lane highway. He looks back into the rearview mirror at Meg. Her head is turned toward the window, her lips pursed together. He glances back and forth between the road and the rearview. Watch the road, Billy snaps. As Tom's eyes break from Meg's profile and move to the road, a deer runs from the left shoulder onto the pavement, a blur of tawny hide in the car's headlights. Tom slams on the brakes, swerving to the right, but even as he swerves, he knows the hit is imminent. The car slides on a patch of ice, and the left front of it slams into the deer with a terrible thud. He can hear the girls screaming from the back seat, and for a moment they are all suspended together, just waiting for the car to stop, which it finally does after careening into the ditch. The force of its stop jolts them all, and Tom hears his neck crack loudly. Then for one perfect second, everything is quiet, the headlights lighting up the edge of the snowy field they've landed in. Jesus Christ, Billy says. Tom punches the steering wheel. Fuck! It's as if time lapsed for a second. Motherfucker, goddamn fucking bullshit! He fumbles for the door handle, trying to get out, then punches the door, the sound ringing through the car. He leans his head back against the headrest. Are you guys okay? Billy asks, turning toward the girls. I want to get out, June says. I want to get out of the car. God damn it, Meg says. Just from the tone of her voice, Tom can feel her eyes on the back of his head, blaming him for everything, along with the rest of them. His guts writhe. Billy opens the door and pushes his seat up. Come on, June. Come on and get out, he says, taking her by the hand. It's all right, baby. We're all fine. It's okay. Then Tom is alone with Meg. The sound of June and Billy's car door slamming rings through the highway darkness. He says nothing to her. He wants her to say something first. She must make the first move so that he knows how to respond. Politics, the structure of love. He rubs his hand across his brow and her sobs start before she gets any words out. I'm sorry, Tom. I shouldn't have said anything. I should have just let you drive. I'm so sorry. The apology comes too easily, too cleanly. He doesn't trust it. You're not sorry. You're happy. This is the kind of thing you wait for. You just wait for me to fuck up so you can be right. Tom gets out, pushing his door open against the slope of the ditch. The ground is slippery and he stumbles, falls on one knee, and then takes the few steps up to the road. Meg stays in the car and he doesn't turn to look at her through the glass. Shit, I'm sorry, Tom says to June and Billy. It came out of nowhere. I didn't see it till it was right in front of the car. June and Billy are quiet, but Billy doesn't look at Tom, and June has her eyebrows set. He can feel the weight of their judgments, and it makes him want to tell them to go fuck themselves and walk away, but he can't. He's stuck with them, stuck with the Honda in the ditch. Meg finally makes her way out and stands next to June, taking her hand. They stand behind the car, staring at its dusty Minnesota license plate. Tom crosses the road and stands behind a small, shrubby tree to take a piss. It is there amongst the shrubs that he finds the doe. Her nose is black and wet. A thin line of warm blood trails from it to the snow. Like tree branches, her long, lean legs stretch out from her heavy belly. Her breath is jagged, evidenced by the uneven movements of her stomach. Tom hears Billy talking from back across the highway. I bet the car will still run. It doesn't look too bad, just a little banged up. Don't worry, Meg. The car starts. Hear that, Tom? He calls. It started right up. Footsteps come from behind, and soon Meg is by his side. She inhales sharply. She's alive, Tom. I know. Oh, Tom, Meg says, suddenly burying her face in his shoulder. What are we going to do? Can we call someone? We can do something for her, can't we? Tom steps forward so she can no longer lean on him. Great idea, Meg, he says. Let's find someone to call. Maybe the cops. He turns back toward Billy and June. Hey, Meg here says we should call someone. You know, like the fucking cops. Meg grabs the back of his jacket. Tom, don't. She's gonna be here all alone. That's the way things work sometimes. Billy and June walk over. Shit, Billy says. June goes to Meg and puts an arm around her shoulder. Don't look at it, Meg, she says, turning them both around and leading them back toward the Honda. The car's okay, Tom, Billy says. Let's just go. He starts to turn around, but Tom stays there. Did you hear me, Tom? Let's get out of here. He waits another moment, then walks toward Meg and June. Tom hears only two car doors slam. He's sure that Meg is still outside, waiting, watching. A picture of Karen flashes in his mind, and he thinks about how the world comes from sepia into color on the arm of someone new. He breathes in and out. Now it will come up from where it has been gestating, and he will not be able to deny it. Tom kneels down near the doe. Her eyes are open, watery slits. He puts a knee on her flank and a hand around her muzzle, then quickly twists her head away from her body, snapping her neck. A sigh of exertion barely escapes his lips. When the doe's stomach stops, he is free. He stands there for a moment, calm. There's only the occasional rustle of the wind through the trees. The world is blank, and in the blankness, he thinks of nothing. He is roused back into the unfolded scene when Meg drops her purse on the ground. She's staring at him, frozen. She knows everything now, he thinks. He spits on the concrete, then walks past her toward the car. June and Billy have climbed back out and are also staring at him. Meg darts in front of him and pushes him back, not once, but twice. You son of a bitch! How could you do that to her? She stops, desolate silence growing between them. Take us back. It's all ruined. I want you to take us back. I want to go back now. He grits his teeth. You can't ever really go back. You know that. Just take me home. Get in the car, he says, brushing past her. Billy and Tom push the car out of the ditch. Then Billy crawls in the back with June and Meg sits in front with Tom. And the car stays quiet, even its stereo mute, as Tom drives them back north where winter will wear on for at least another 6 weeks.
If Darcy's voice sounded familiar, that's because she read the part of Dead Wendy in our February edition of the podcast. Her own stories have been published in numerous print and online journals, and she's at work on her first novel. And for the record, lest I seem ungrateful, I am always thankful to have podcast listeners. Here is a monthly literary podcast production of mnartist.org. mnartist.org is a joint project of the Walker Art Center and the McKnight Foundation. The mission of mnartist.org is to improve the lives of Minnesota artists and provide access to and engagement with Minnesota's arts culture.